You give Teller from Jerusalem 20 minutes, and he'll give you the education of a lifetime. King of the Storytellers and the Shakespeare of the Torah world, here is Rabbi Hanoch Teller.
Welcome, everyone, to Teller from Jerusalem, and I'm your host, Hanoch Teller. We are now Season 4, Episode 4. We resume and conclude a chapter most fitting for our character series about the stirring life of Rabbi Yehuda Kelemer from West Hempstead, New York. For the full story, a story that will undoubtedly change and improve your lives, I recommend you acquire his biography entitled, If Not Higher, written by yours truly, which you may find discounted at our website, www.hanochteller.com, www.hanochteller.com, or at Jewish bookstores. Get two for a deeper understanding. Not to mention that you will surely wish to gift this enchanting book to others. It's a small price for a major life improvement. We resume our story. One woman related to Rabbi Kelemer that her husband was in the hospital near the end of his battle with cancer, and then he had a stroke. Rabbi Kelemer responded, "I'll be right there." Now, this is a woman who did not live in West Hempstead. She was not a member of his synagogue, but that never made any difference to him. He said to her, "I'll be right there, but I'm in Rhode Island, but I'll be there soon." Now, the distance from Rhode Island to West Hempstead is not like going from Hartford to West Hempstead. It's not a drive or a train ride from Far Rockaway to West Hempstead. This is more like Baltimore to West Hempstead. He stayed with that woman. He arrived and he stayed with her throughout that agonizing week and is with her husband till the very end. He then buried him, her husband, and then he stayed with her for the week of mourning and was always in contact with her ever since. Whenever Rabbi Kelemer dealt with someone, he dealt exclusively with that person, and you never felt that he was trying to juggle many things at once. Richie Grossman related that when his closest friend's wife underwent the C-section in her 27th week, he was torn as what he should do first, and he just properly could not evaluate, so he called up Rabbi Kelemer. Rabbi Kelemer answered the question with a question: "Which hospital is she in? Because I'll go over there right away." But this is information that Richie would not reveal. Rabbi Kelemer, who was still right after his accident, could not drive and he could barely walk, even with his walker. Richie never wished to be disrespectful to his rabbi, but could not allow him to subject himself to such difficulty for a couple that he did not even know. In desperation, Richie stated to Rabbi Kelemer, "I'm not telling you which hospital, but I can tell you that getting there entails going over a bridge." Rabbi Kelemer sounded so relieved by this information. "Well," the rabbi exclaimed with satisfaction, "that narrows it down." One lady related that she had knee surgery. Now, I can't describe this to you because thank God I've been spared, but I'm told that it is screaming soprano pain. So here she is, just released from the hospital, lying on her couch on Shabbat, and she has all kinds of pillows and blankets and ice cubes and ice packs. And then she sees, to her horror, Shabbat afternoon at 1:30, Rabbi Kelemer coming up her driveway with his walker, trying to hobble along. And so she right away gets rid of the pillows and the blankets and tosses the ice packs, and she stands up as best as she can. Rabbi Kelemer comes in and he says, "Good Shabbos. I just wanted to wish you good Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom on my way home from Shul." Now, Rabbi Kelemer lived a block and a half away from the synagogue. She lived 2.5 miles away. It's 1:30 in the afternoon. He's making like he's on his way home from, who knows how many people he visited already. And then Rabbi Kelemer noticed her walker and he said, "Ah, let's have a race." And the two of them, like little children, giggling around the apartment, around the home, went with their walkers. That's what he always did. He made a person feel so good. And afterwards, she forgot her pain for quite a while. Not only does charity begin at home, so does chesed and so does kindness. The rabbi's ability to make other people feel great was not just restricted to strangers. Mr. Jeremy Strauss related that he once went to the airport, JFK Airport in New York, to pick up a relative early in the morning. In an airport like any public place containing crowds so dense that people appear to be standing in queues just to walk around the terminal, it's hard to recognize anyone in this sea of humanity. But Jeremy Strauss had no problem recognizing Rabbi Kelemer hobbling on his walker with a gleeful smile on his face and a bouquet of flowers in his hand to greet his wife, who was returning at 5:30 in the morning from a brief trip to Israel. The Solomon Schechter High School in Long Island, a school high school under the auspices of the conservative movement, wanted to join the Orthodox High School Basketball League, but was denied because they are a conservative school, and there was fear that they would have a, quote, bad influence upon the kids from Orthodox homes. Rabbi Kelemer was quite upset about this, and his take was that perhaps our kids could have a positive influence upon them. And now quite another important story regarding sensitivity. On a Thursday night in May 2001, a Jerusalem wedding was morphed into unprecedented tragedy. The dance floor crammed with wedding guests clapping and dancing, with flashing disco lights and thumping music, suddenly collapsed, plunging hundreds of screaming celebrants into an abyss of concrete, sparks, and dust.
In 2001, negligence, corner cutting, and pow-cow construction techniques led to one of the deadliest building collapses in Israel's history. A day that bride-to-be Karen, her groom Asaf, their families and friends had all long anticipated, planned to be one of the happiest of their lives. Wedding ceremonies by day, and that following evening, festivities, fun, drinking, dancing, 600 plus in attendance celebrating the night away. At roughly 10:45 on the 24th of May, 2001, the third-story dance floor holding the main congregation of dancing partygoers collapsed without so much as a split second of warning.
Aside from the 24 that were killed, more than 300 were seriously injured in the deadliest building collapse in Israel's history, all of it captured in a dreadful wedding video broadcast all over the world. The catastrophe was on everyone's lips that Friday and Shabbos. One congregant approached Rabbi Kelemer Shabbat morning and asked if they should feel bad over the deaths of these irreligious Jews at the Jerusalem wedding. The questioner did not get an immediate answer. That Shabbos, the rabbi visited every single minyan in the Young Israel. Generally, he would rotate between the different prayer services, so that every few weeks he would address each and every one of the services, but not in that particular Shabbos. To each and every minyan, he repeated the question that was posed to him, and then he said, "I have failed as a rabbi, if such a question could be asked." There was perhaps a silver lining to that Versailles wedding hall collapse, and the beneficial and major life-saving impact it would later have upon the future of United Hatzalah Emergency Medical Response Team in Israel. When emergencies occur, rapid medical treatment increases chances of survival exponentially. Using specially equipped motorcycle ambulances, United Hatzalah's network of more than 7,000 volunteer medics helps save thousands of lives each year across Israel, providing medical treatment in an average of response time of under 90 seconds. It is beyond the scope of this podcast to analyze why Hatzalah felt it was necessary to open a second medical relief team and not rely exclusively upon Magen David Adom, or MDA, Israel's Red Cross. Initially, Eli Beer, who founded Hatzalah in Israel because there was a desperate need to get to aid to the victims in minutes and avoid traffic that clogged all of the arteries, worked under the umbrella of MDA. It was not difficult for him to expose that the current system was not effective in dealing with emergencies, responding to terror explosions, and mass catastrophes. Now, before we have a closer look at what happened exactly at Versailles, that wedding hall, which was, of course, named after the prestigious hall in France, although Magen David Adom's people were always the ones to transport the victims to the hospital, they had the ambulances, it was the Hatzalah volunteers who were first responders after murderous attacks, be it terrorist explosions or any catastrophe. Since they're usually the first on the scene, it was Hatzalah volunteers who were tasked with performing triage, responsibility almost beyond human endurance, but something that had to be done. Triage means that EMTs on the scene need to make split-second decisions about who they feel has a better chance of living, who's definitely going to die. The ones with a better chance are the ones that the rescue teams will usually focus their efforts upon. Now, exactly when this general term of triage began is usually associated with the medical application, it's not really clear. Though the earliest execution of the practice may have been by Baron Dominique Jean Lory, Surgeon-in-Chief to Napoleon's Imperial Guard in the early 1790s. To the best of my knowledge, it became the standard method of coping with the wounded during World War I. In World War I, there were mass deaths, gas canisters that were tossed, or explosions. And so the triage team would then separate into three piles. Those that they felt were not going to survive or not worth the effort. Another pile of those that needed to be evacuated from the battlefield so they could get medical attention and they would survive. And those that could be quickly patched up and returned and recycled back to battle. Hatzalah's fast response and their expertise at triage was instrumental in saving untold lives. But Eli Beer, the founder, understood that Hatzalah would never be able to accomplish all that it could as long as it was composed of different local and sometimes fractious branches that needed to be united into one national organization. Eli Beer understood, but this was a hard press on convincing the different localities that different approaches to unite, and then Versailles happened. What I'm about to tell you is primarily called from the book about Eli Beer and Unite Hatzalah, authored by Nachman Seltzer. Aside from Versailles Wedding Hall and the Miron tragedy, time after time, United Hatzalah has proven that within 90 seconds, it will effectively respond to a call for help. United Hatzalah's medal was put to the ultimate test on October 7, when hordes of murderous Hamas terrorists laid siege to Israel, and instantaneously, United Hatzalah sprang into action. Here's actress Gal Gadot offering her acknowledgement of United Hatzalah's work, particularly in wake of October 7.
It's incredible to think about the 7,000 volunteers from all different backgrounds, Jews, Christians, Muslims, all coming together with one goal, to save lives. This organization embodies the spirit and unity of Israel in such a profound way, the best of Israel. On October 7th, they really show their true colors. Their bravery and quick action, their willingness to step into crisis situations with so much hope and compassion is just incredible. It was a real testament to their character and the vital role they play in our community. I believe it's important for all of us to support United Hatzalah. By standing with them, we're helping to ensure that they can continue their incredible life-saving work.
Eli Beer was present and in the neighborhood when the Versailles tragedy occurred. He caught sight of a white cloud rising into the night, and for the life of me couldn't understand what on earth was what he was seeing. It turned out that it was the Versailles Wedding Hall that had just collapsed, causing a huge dust cloud to rise into the air. As Ellie and his fellow volunteers raced over to the scene, they saw a man running towards them. He was completely white from head to toe, as if he had fallen into a vat of white flour. And as he ran, he was screaming, "We need ambulances, ambulances, send ambulances, the building collapsed." Ellie responded, "We have an ambulance," trying to catch the man's attention, asking him, "Where's the building?" But the man was just simply incapable of answering. He kept on running down the street screaming. Ellie and a team of EMTs jumped into their ambulance. It was an MDA ambulance, but they were using it with permission for their Hatzalah shift, and got onto the ambulance radio. Ellie did not waste a second. He drove the ambulance the short distance to the wedding hall, and when he arrived there, he couldn't believe what he was seeing. It looked like a scene out of a horror movie. People were literally hanging from the ceiling, holding onto metal struts. They were sticking out of the concrete. People were balancing precariously on tiny leftover pieces of floor. Or maybe they were stuck in their place. It was hard to tell. And they were screaming for help. Ellie had to be sure that every single EMT got themselves over to the wedding hall so they could begin saving lives. He got on the radio in the ambulance and gave the report of his life. "Command center?" The response was, "This is command center. Who is this?" It happened to have been it was Ellie's cousin, Dovi Meisel, his right hand from the very start, was manning MDA's command center that night. "Dovi, it's Ellie. Listen to me. This is an emergency. The Versailles Wedding Hall in Talpiot just collapsed. I need every single MDA ambulance that's available in Jerusalem, Ma'ale Adumim, Beit Shemesh, and everywhere else in the surrounding area. Every ambulance has got to come here immediately." Ellie remained on the radio, continued to report what he saw, staying calm despite the terrible things that were happening just a few feet away from him. It was the biggest civilian disaster that had happened since the formation of the State of Israel, and it would remain that way until the Hebron tragedy that occurred on April 30th, 2021. The Versailles Wedding Hall catastrophe would leave an impression on Eli for the rest of his life. In the moment, he realized how important it is for a person reporting the details of everything happening at a scene to remain calm and collected, even if on the inside you're being torn apart, and relay factual feedback so that emergency rescue teams would know what is needed and what needed to be done. Within 3.5 hours, all the wounded who weren't completely trapped beneath the rubble had been removed and were on their way to the hospital. Hatzalah and Magen David Adom weren't equipped to move huge piles of rubble, for that the Army's Home Front Command would have to do this with their tractors and heavy earth-moving equipment. But the MDA personnel and Hatzalah volunteers worked nonstop to save as many lives as they possibly could. It was yet another wake-up call reminding Eli of the importance of uniting the different branches of Hatzalah. He was able to see in real time how much more effective they could be, and needed to be, if they worked together. One simply couldn't compare having volunteers from just one city available to send out on calls, no matter how many volunteers there were, with having the ability to call volunteers from all over the country as part of the same network. I knew that they would have to unite, that the infighting and disagreements had to stop for the sake of the people they all wanted to help. And one other thing happened to him that night. He realized that during that period he'd come to recognition that in that night of sadness, death, and loss, while giving clear and fluid guidance to thousands of people throughout the night that never seemed to end, Eli Beer came to understand something about himself. At that moment, he grasped that he'd been blessed with genuine leadership skills from the one above and was meant to use them for the sake of his people. Little did he know that those skills would be put to the test in a big way, all starting with the Versailles Wedding Hall, which was a milestone to bring all of Hatzalah under one umbrella. Back to West Hempstead. The West Hempstead Young Israels, their janitor's name was Tom Laverty, an Irish-American. The people in the synagogue referred to him jokingly as Rabbeinu Tom. When his son, the fireman, died, the rabbi attended the funeral. And when Tom was in the hospital for what turned out to be his final ailment, the hospital broke the news that it was time to call his priest for the last rites. "Nothing doing," Tom Laverty pronounced. "Don't call my priest, call my rabbi." And like father, like daughter, Tom's daughter Jennifer was diagnosed with a medical condition that did not have a clear path for the most efficient cure. The ailment was treatable, but each method contained a different drawback and risk. Jennifer took her notes when she spoke to a religious Jewish doctor in the Five Towns who told her the pluses and the advantages of each method and their drawbacks. And then Jennifer responded and said, "I have to ask my rabbi." Okay, so let's conclude this by asking what I call a challenge, the Rabbi Kellermer challenge. There is a family not from West Hempstead, but rather from, I believe, Merrick, Long Island. And the family, the kids were modern Orthodox, much more emphasis on the modern than the Orthodox. They attended a day school. And for the gap year, the oldest son went to Israel. He was supposed to go for 1 year. He attended a yeshiva, and 1 year then morphed into a second year, into a third year, and he flipped, and he became a lifer. And then, the next child, a girl, she also came to Israel for her gap year. And instead of going to a seminary for just 1 year, she went for 2 years, morphed into third year, transmogrified into a fourth year, and she too became a lifer. The parents didn't know what to do with themselves. Their kids were just flipping out. They wondered maybe they should check their mezuzos. When it came to the youngest daughter, Jessica, they had to shield her and make sure that she wouldn't flip out also. So what they did was, first of all, it was off the table that she would travel to Israel for a gap year. They shielded her from any religious influence, and they wouldn't even let her talk to someone who had facial hair. And then something which was not expected happened. Jessica's mom, in her kindness and benevolence, went out and bought her daughter a beautiful, highly expensive puffer winter coat that goes on sale in Bloomingdale's for $899. And she gave it to her daughter. What a beautiful gift. However, even though Jessica was shielded from any religious influence, she understood innately that this coat was not modest. It was fire engine red. There were neon lights flashing and klaxons ringing. What was she to do? Now, if we'd have to decide such a question, we might reason, Since the mother bought the expensive gift out of love for her daughter and would be hurt, independent of the religious undertones of the decision, if Jessica were to shun the gift, this should be a factor in permitting the wearing of the coat. And nowadays, red is not the only color that draws the eye. There's canary yellow, there's hot pink, fluorescent orange. All of them scream for attention. Rabbi Yitzhak Breidowitz has pointed out that many halachic authorities maintain that honoring one's parents is not applicable in an instance where conduct would violate accepted norms of modesty. Hence, a definitive position cannot be adopted in this catch-22. Furthermore, the assumption that honoring one's parents trumps modesty is a matter of halachic controversy beyond the pay scale of this garden variety layperson to decide based on common sense or emotion. But as unqualified as we are, we've still learned an approach from Rabbi Kelemer as applicable to regarding a red coat as regarding other factors and aspects of family harmony, business dealings, interaction with others. We've seen repeatedly how Rabbi Kelemer would always weigh sensitivity and emotions with his keen sense of what a halachic ruling can or cannot fail to achieve. As Rabbi J.J. Schachter labeled it, he had the magic to make a psak work. Rabbi Kelemer surely would have endeavored to find a peaceful and pleasant middle ground, to reconcile all the values at stake, the standards of modesty, while expressing gratitude and appreciation for one's mother. He invested all of his energy into avoiding clashes, while at the same time remaining absolutely faithful to halachic imperatives. There's many things that we could suggest, but again, the Rabbi Kelemer approach would have been to adopt a middle ground. In the end, they said to Jessica, your only hope is to approach Rabbi Kelemer. She went with her question via someone else to Rabbi Kelemer. Now, the person who posed this question is no longer alive. I spoke to his widow, and she said she remembers the question, but she cannot remember the answer. But again, one thing we know for sure is Rabbi Kelemer, with his expertise in halacha and Jewish law, would have thought of something that would have been consistent with Jewish law and would never violate someone's sensitivities, certainly not of a child to a mother and a loving mother to her daughter. It should be noted that West Hempstead is a commuter town made up of intelligent, college-educated professionals. And just like every community has no shortage of cynics who make it onto the synagogue board just to ensure that the rabbi has a dynamic relationship with his cardiologist, West Hempstead would have been the same if not for the fact that Rabbi Kelemer's nature and erudition was above, indeed higher, than critique. They revered him, and they admired him. Rabbi Kelemer had traveled far, from Miami to Los Angeles, to New York, to Detroit, to Cleveland, to Jerusalem, to Middle Village, to Brookline, to West Hempstead, to heaven, if not higher. Before we conclude, here's an important announcement. Because of the imminent Passover holiday, we're going to take a brief break in our schedule. Each podcast entails hours and hours of preparation, sometimes even days. Accordingly, there's not remain enough time to prepare the kind of quality that you are accustomed to, so our preparatory research is going to force us only to resume, please God, on May 15, 2024. In our next episode, we will return to our early struggle to build the State of Israel, critical information to know when Israel's very existence is being assaulted by a web of lies that thoroughly distort the truth and no historical basis, as we have explained and continue to do so. Thank you very much to Howard the Cheetah Felsen, our expert sound engineer. Thanks for listening to Teller from Jerusalem, where this series takes a never-fail approach how to inculcate good character. Spread knowledge by giving us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. Join us next time for a brand new episode, and be sure to visit tellerfromjerusalem.com. You can find more details about this show and other useful information. Check out the site store, and just by inserting the TFJ code, you will receive an additional 10% discount off the already very reduced price of all Chanoch Teller products, books, lectures, and documentaries. And remember, don't forget, you can get Teller from Jerusalem on any podcast platform or go to tellerfromjerusalem.com.